Hare Krishna. Welcome. So today I'm going to, I've entitled this talk, Krishna, Hiding in Plain Sight. There he is. Hiding in Plain Sight. We're going to be talking about a lot about, I'm going to address some of the talk from 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, primarily. When does our consciousness, our God consciousness, our spiritual awareness begin in life? Well, our awareness, our self-awareness, can begin even in infancy. Somewhere around the time that we stop sticking our toes in our mouth. Somewhere after that. And we're either heading toward what? A sense of the self as Atma, the true self, the real self, the soul. Or predominantly a sense of the self as ego, ahankara, the illusory self, the false self. Are some people born with a higher state of consciousness? They are. They are. How so? Depends on what they did in the previous lifetime. Lifetimes, it will determine where you pick up in your current life. You pick up where you left off. In terms of spiritual awareness, sometimes for some it's up and running right from the beginning. You've seen these children who ask profound questions from a very young age, sometimes 1 year old. They start thinking of God, the universe, why we're here, who are we, what are we doing? This is not uncommon. Sometimes spiritual awareness takes time to develop over time. And sometimes we've spoken about this before, and sometimes it happens through an epiphany or a sudden awakening. A lucid moment could be of any of those things, or for some people it just doesn't happen. We see historically and in our world, even indigenous people, tribal people who live out in the middle of nowhere in a jungle, on top of a mountain or wherever, in a desert, often have God consciousness, do they not? It's very common. They have some sense of the divine or the almighty or something beyond themselves that is animating their world and for which they should have, they should give thanks, they should evoke, and they do various rituals and ceremonies. We see this in many cultures. And then we have people who don't believe, like Haribo, like atheists. They don't believe. Some of them say, well, if there is a God, let's see him. Show him to me. Then I'll believe. So all he has to do is show himself. Here I am. My eyes are open. Kinda. So here's an analogy for that. Suppose you go into a bank and you want to open an account. And you approach the teller and you say, I would like to see the bank president. President of the bank. Yes, sir. Well, what can we help you with? I would like to open an account. Very good, sir. I can help you right here. How much did you want to deposit in your account today? 100 euros. 100 euros. I think we can take care of that right for you right here, sir. I'd like to see the bank president. He's not available right now. You won't be seeing the bank president. Suppose you come into the bank to open your account, and you say, same thing again, I wish to open an account, and I want to see the bank president. Yes, sir, well, how much are you going to open your account with? 100,000 euros. 100,000 euros. I tell you what, you can speak to one of the managers here, one of the vice presidents here in the bank of accounts. We'll assign a personal account supervisor for you if you're going to put in that much money. Correct? Yeah, but I want to see the bank president. Well, the bank president's not available. Sorry. Suppose you come in and you say, I want to see the bank president. I'm opening an account. And you say, I'm going to put in 100 million euros. There you go. You got sound effects there. And I want to see the bank president. Yes, sir. No problem. We will make an appointment for you with the bank president. Isn't it? Does that sound reasonable to you? Why? Because you have a qualification for seeing the bank president. There's a need. There's substance behind it. So, same thing with God. When you qualify yourself, you can see God. But that takes a little doing. And the more you put in, the more you get out. Does that work too in spiritual life? The more you put in, the more you get out of it. You want to see Krishna? You want to see God? No problem. You can see. You just have to put in your 100 million euros worth of time, energy, devotion, and spiritual practice, whatever form that takes, and you can see God. But what about those of us who haven't done that? What are we to do? Well, of course, we got to continue our spiritual practice or begin it if we haven't done so. But Krishna says, don't worry. I'm right here in front of you in so many things, in so many ways. It's easy for you to see me and to recognize me. Let me count the ways for you. Let me tell you in what ways. No messages, please. Let me tell you how. So let's begin with 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. 7th chapter, 8th verse. Rasoham apsukanteya. I am the taste in water. I am the rasa, the taste in water. You know that water is the thing that satisfies thirst. You can drink Coca-Cola and you can drink... What do they put in those drinks? Like, I can't even think of it now. Gatorade. Well, maybe they don't have that here. Nutrients and, I don't know, different things they put in. But what satisfies the thirst more than anything? Pure water. Correct? And what can we mix pure water with, my friends? Anything and everything imaginable. And it mixes quite nicely, doesn't it? Except with oil, of course. Apart from oil. Yeah. And that taste, that pure taste, that's God. That's Krishna. Then he says, I'm the original fragrance of the earth. Punyo Ganda Prithivyam Cha. So earth, has fragrance. When we look at the elements, ether has sound, and air, wind, provides touch. Fire provides form. Water provides taste. This is how creation actually begins, from one to the next. And earth provides fragrance, aroma. So he says, I'm the original fragrance of the earth. You know that fragrance when you smell really, really rich soil that's fertile and in which you can plant anything, pretty much. It has that wonderful earthy smell. What can you compare that smell to? Nothing. It smells like earth. It smells like dirt. Right? So, that also is how God is appearing to us. Through that smell. That aroma. Then he says, Tejas chasmi vibhavasau. In fire, I am the heat. What do you do with fire? Can't cook without fire. Can't heat your home without fire. Can't drive an engine without fire. So many applications. There he says, I'm the heat in the fire. Of course, we also know fire provides light. And then he concludes this section and he says, Bijam mam sarvabhutanam vidhi partha sanatanam. That I am the eternal seed of all existences. Everything that takes birth or begins as an inception point grows, develops from seed form, whatever that seed form may be, fetus form, egg form, whatever. I am that seed. I am that beginning. So this is another way in which, or perception that we have of God. He's explaining to Arjuna here in the 10th chapter all the ways in which he can be perceived in the world around us. And then what does he do in the 11th chapter to sort of cap this explanation? He reveals his what?
Universal form.
His universal form, his Vishvarupa, which for Arjuna, the sky disappears, the earth disappears, and everything 360 degrees is just God in all his myriad forms, as if you were in the middle of the cosmos. No sense of direction or what's up and what's down. It was just completely suffused with God's energies and forms. That happens in the 11th chapter. Universal form is very famous around the world. Everybody has seen various depictions of the universal form. And after a while, Arjuna says, please, please, please take it away. It's too much. It's overwhelming, overly powerful. Okay, so now we're in the 10th chapter. And Arjuna says, you know, Krishna, your mighty, tell me again in detail about your mighty potencies and glories. I never tire of hearing of them. And Krishna answers, he says, yes, I will tell you of my splendorous manifestations, but only those which are prominent, because, O Arjuna, my opulence is unlimited. So he's only mentioning a few. He's highlighting. That's all he's doing. So let's continue. Aham Atma Guda Kesha. Aham Atma, what's he saying? I am the self. I am the soul. I am identity. The soul, the Atma, or Jiva, is the true identity. That is you. Well, where is it? It's in there. It's in your heart. It's underneath everything. But it's become covered over. By what? By your material identification. Since you were born? Yes. But not simply since you were born, for multiple lifetimes. Last time I was here, we explained about cleansing the mirror of the mind. The mind is a spotless mirror and only reflects, in this case, the soul. Then, each time we take a birth, we have a different material identification and a different experience throughout our lives. And we are putting on layers and layers and layers of conditioning and perceptions and misperceptions and illusory perceptions. So the soul, the true self, the true perception of self is still there. It's underneath, and it gets covered over by all of these different layers over time. So he doesn't say that he's ego. He says he's self. He's not ahankara, he's atma. So the closer you get to realizing you're a spiritual being and subsequently acting like one, the closer you get to the realization, well, this is God. This is the connection. And he says, sarva bhuta shaya stita, situated within the hearts of all beings. Sarva bhuta, does it mean all humans? No. It means all beings. In a butterfly? Yeah. In a caterpillar? Yes. In a lizard? Oh, yes. Everything. Then he says, Jyotishang Ravir Angshuman. So, of lights. Jyoti means light. The science of astrology, Vedic astrology, is called Jyotish in Sanskrit, which means the science of light. That's what it means, because it provides enlightenment. So he says, of lights or of luminaries, I am the radiant sun. We love the sun. Less so in India and in desert areas and in Arabia. But generally in the West, we love the sun. Because it's warm. And it's beautiful. And sunny days, what is the effect of a sunny day on the psyche of the people? What's the effect? How often do people say, isn't it a beautiful day? When they say, isn't it a beautiful day, you can pretty much bet that what they're referring to is what? It's sunny. Correct? It could be cold, and they'll still say, isn't it a beautiful day, right? So the sun, I'm not going to get into all its wonderful qualities because we'd be here for the full hour. But the sun also, can you look at the sun? No, you can't. You can, but you can't. Not for very long. Because of its power and its energy and its brightness. Then he says, nakshatranam ahang shashi. Among the nakshatras, among the stars,
I am Shashi. Who's Shashi?
The moon.
What does Shashi mean in Sanskrit? Yes, it means moon, but there's actually a meaning before it means moon. What does it mean? It means rabbit. It means rabbit. What does a rabbit do? Hops. What does the moon do? Hops from sign to sign to sign to sign. Hops to the zodiac. I know it doesn't look like that when you look up in the sky. But meaning, it's like a rabbit. It doesn't stay in one place for too long. The moon goes through the 12 signs of the zodiac in how many days?
28.
28 days. Right? Stays in a sign, remains, it doesn't stay in the sign. It passes through the sign for the length of 2 1/4 days. Fastest planet in the solar system. So, 28 days, we've passed through the whole thing. And Saturn, how long does it take Saturn to pass through the entire zodiac? 12 signs. 28 to 30 years. 28 to 30 years. He's the tortoise. The moon's the rabbit. That's why it's Shashi. Now, nakshatra are the constellations. We know about the constellations. We learned about them in school, but we didn't usually learn about the Vedic constellations. The Vedic constellations are 27 in number. And they're not named what the Greeks named them. They're very, very different. And each constellation extends for a boundary of 13 degrees, 20 minutes. 13 degrees, 20 minutes. 13, 20 times 27 is 360 degrees. There's your circle. That's how it works. The constellations are very important in Vedic astrology. Your moon position at birth is extremely important because the moon is the planet that represents the mind. And as I've said numerous times, as the mind goes, so we go. Our state of mind in our world is everything, isn't it? If we have a positive state of mind, if we're in a happy state of mind, we're having a good day, usually. And if we don't feel good, or we're down, or some this or that has happened, we don't usually have a good day. It colors our outlook, doesn't it? It colors our outlook on everything. So the moon, when you're born, is going to be in one of the 12 signs of the zodiac, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, etc. Then we also calculate to find out which nakshatra, which constellation the moon will be in. Your moon will be in. And that tells us a whole plethora of information separate from what we normally think about in terms of the signs, Aries, Taurus, Gemini. The constellations, being 27 in number, are divided into three gunas, or categories. And they are Deva, Nara, and Rakshasa. So, three times, there's nine constellations in each of those categories. Nine times three is 27. So a Rakshasa constellation, even though Rakshasa literally means demon in Sanskrit, it does not necessarily mean demon. Strictly speaking, it means somebody who is not as yet as evolved. There's still more evolution that that soul must undergo. So what would such people be like? Well, the far end of that spectrum would be criminals, or people who are thieves, murderers, you make your list. You know, people who are out to prey on others. That's the far end. Also in that same category are people who are self-centered, or people who use intimidation on others, or people who are angry a lot, and people who try to control others for their own benefit. This would also be an example of that. And so we would need more evolution, greater consciousness and self-improvement, so that in the next life we would rise up above that. Have I seen, after 40 years of doing Vedic astrology, have I seen spiritual people born with Rakshasa constellations for their moon? Oh yes, many, many, many. It does not preclude spiritual people. It doesn't. It just means there's some area of their life that probably needs to be realized, evolved, and lessons to be learned. The middle category is Nara or Manushya, which means what? Human. Well, that's us. We're human. Humans are pretty much absorbed in what they want. They're running around chasing after things, chasing after desires. Now, there are a certain amount of things that you may need in life. You might want to obviously have a job and perhaps have a career, get married, have a family, have children, get a house. I mean, you know, these are human things. These are natural no matter where you go. Humans are pretty much self-absorbed. Or by extrapolation, maybe, you know, absorbed in their family and friends. They want to further themselves, but they may want to further their family and friends as well. That's humans. The last category, the highest category, are Deva. Deva means?
Lord.
Sorry?
Lord.
Godly. Divine. More attuned. More realized. That's Deva. What would the symptoms of a Deva constellation be? They would be less self-involved, less self-motivated. They would be... Not that humans could not be kind also, so let's be clear on that, but these would be people whose lives are dedicated to the upliftment or the welfare of humanity, or a segment of humanity, and would be dedicated to charitable works or philanthropic works or altruistic works, or even higher, dedicated to enlightenment of others through spiritual knowledge and spiritual teaching. So that's how the constellations work. So of all the constellations, I am the moon. That's what Krishna says here. And we know from Shastra that all avatars, especially the major ones of Vishnu, of God, each avatar is born in a particular planetary dynasty. A planetary dynasty, in case you didn't know that. And our friend and our worshipable Lord here, Krishna, the all-attractive one, is born in what dynasty?
The moon dynasty.
The moon dynasty. Chandra Vangsha. The moon dynasty. and Lord Ram,
Suryavamsha,
the Sun Dynasty. And Nrsingadev, half man, half lion, who was Prahlad's worshipable lord, or became so. Which dynasty was Nrsingadev born in? Mars dynasty. Saturn is born in the Kurma dynasty. Or Kurma, yeah, that's it. That's Saturn. Kurma is born in the Saturn dynasty, sorry. Other way around. Nrsingadev is born in the Mars dynasty. So, Mars is Mungo. Okay. Then he continues and he says, Rudranam Shankarash Chasmi. I am Shankar. Of the Rudras, I am Shiva. Then he says, of the Yakshas and the Rakshasas, you know, who are these are beings that are, they're not necessarily demoniac, let's just call them more materialistic. The Yakshas and the Rakshasas. And among them, I am whom? He says, Vitesho. Vita Isha. Who is that?
Kuvera.
You must know this by heart by now. Kuvera, the Lord of Wealth. Now, it's interesting. I'm just going to throw this out here because, after all, this is Ireland. Kuvera is supposed to be short and not all that good looking. There are accounts that explain that. And he's very much focused on money. You know, it may put somebody in charge of money who's thinking about money all the time. It says in when you read Raja Dharma, the path of kingship and leadership, it says that your finance minister has got to be somebody who's absolutely dedicated and focused on profit. He's got to know how to make money. Otherwise, what's he doing being your finance minister? That's what it says in the Shastra. So, Kuvera is short, not particularly good looking, and he's always thinking about money. What is the history in Ireland around that? Who do we have? The leprechauns, my friends. There have been connections made by certain parties between the yakshas and the leprechauns because the leprechauns are small. Some of them, perhaps, are, I've been told, haven't seen them, not particularly good looking. I better be careful here because they do come after people. That is historically been proven. And they're always waiting for what at the end of the rainbow? The pot of gold. Isn't it true? There you go. So we're here in the land of the Kuveras, so to speak. Anyway, that's something you can muse on for a while in your spare time. Vasunam Pavakash Chasmi. What does that mean? Of the Vasus, who are a group of demigods, I am Agni. Who's Agni?
Fire.
The god of fire. Agni. Demigod. And where do we use this word in English? Ignatius. Ignition. Ignite. This all comes from Agni. Because, my friends, it all comes from Sanskrit. Believe me. That's one example. And then, Meru Shikari Namaham. Shikari of mountains. I am. You're waiting for him to say Everest Shikari Namaham. Doesn't say that. It says Meru. Where do you find Meru? Where can we go to see Meru here? Meru is in the middle of the entire creation. The entire creation. You can't see it from your vantage point. And everything revolves around Meru. The entire cosmic manifestation goes around Meru. All the universes go around Meru. Now, you can research that. That's available. Prabhupada has talked about it. And then some of my God brothers, our God brothers, have written, who are PhDs in this and that, have written books to describe that in greater detail for those of you that are interested. So he says, I am Mount Meru. Then he says, Senani nam aham skandha. So of generals or of military leaders, I am Skanda. Who is Skanda? Kartikeya. And in the south, what do you call him? Subramanyam. Or they also call Murugan. Right? So that is, and he is son of Shiva. Shiva has two sons, Ganesh and Skanda. And then he says, Sadasam Asmi Sagaraha. Beautiful. Sadasa are bodies of water. Of all bodies of water, you will know me when you see the what? The Sagara, the ocean. What is more awesome than the ocean in terms of bodies of water? Nothing. Isn't it curious how the ocean is filled constantly by rivers from all over the place? And sometimes, as we know, there are tremendous storms, and storms wreak havoc. Here in Ireland, we've had some serious flooding over the last few years. Does the ocean flood? No. Rivers flood. Streams flood. Sometimes lakes, depending. Never the ocean. It's always contained. Then he goes on to say, Maharshinam Brigur Aham. Of great sages, I am Brigu. Brigu is the father of which planetary deity? Venus. Who said Venus? Venus. Exactly. Shukra. Brigu is also a sage that has a lot to do with astrology. For those of you, I'm sure some of you know this, there is a book, and it is called the Brigu Sanghita. And the Brigu Sanghita, I've been exposed to this book, not recently, but in my life a few times, a few years ago. And the Brigu Sanghita is the book of life. if there is such a thing as the book of life and everybody's in it, this is it. Is everybody in there?
Oh yeah.
Everybody's in there. Is it a static book? Static meaning I can go to page 834 in this book, or I can go to chapter 18, verse 66. It will be the same every time, correct? That's what I mean by static. The book does not change, right? The Bhagavad Gita is not static. It's dynamic. The pages change. And what may be in here today will not be in there tomorrow. It's dynamic. Have I seen this? I've actually witnessed this. I've held the book in my hands. And because I've studied Sanskrit, I've also read and compared the falls, they call them falls, the readings that were given based on the book, and I compare it to make sure that's where the planets were in the sky, and it's based on that because I was able to do it and it was accurate. So the Bhrigu Sangita can be found in various places in India. Can you just go there and they'll find your name in it? No, it doesn't work like that. They'll find your... Usually what he'll tell you to do, Bhrigu will tell the Vachak, the one who is the speaker or interpreter who has the book, when you are to come. You are supposed to come on the seventh day of the waxing moon in the month of Chaitra. That's when you come. And then we will find your page. And if you come on the sixth day before that, will they find it? No. But they'll find it on the seventh day. That's how it works. I've seen this. That's Bhrigu. Well, I don't want to limit him to that. He's far more than that. They told a story. Let me tell you this story. It's an interesting story. There was a man who was a devotee of Bhrigu. In other words, he would consult the Bhrigu Sangita. He had consulted it through his lifetime, from time to time. Then this guy was then arrested for murder and put in jail, tried and convicted. Was he guilty? No. So he was to be put to death the next morning at sunrise. That was his punishment meted out by the judge of the court. And they gave him one phone call. And he called the place where they had the Bhrigu Sangita. And this story was came from Hosharpur in the Punjab, where I visited. And he had one phone call. And he said, "I'm about to be put to death tomorrow morning at sunrise for a crime which I did not commit. Please, will you intercede? Will you ask Bhrigu what is to become of me?" So they immediately went to the book. Now, this is what they do. They do this. Because they don't know where it's going to be, if it's going to show up. They have to page the book. These volumes, there's two volumes, they're about this thick. They just start going like this. Until, boom, there it is. And there was the answer in the book. So, you know, in other words, one moment, we'll look for you. Put the phone down, start looking. Went back, picked up the phone and said, "Bhrigu said, nothing to worry about. You will not be put to death.
Thank you. Hung up the phone. Back to his cell. Early the next morning, two guards came walking down. The old dead man walking idea. Coming down the long hall to his cell. Opened the cell door, and the judge was there with him. Judges do not go into prisons. Ever. They don't. And he said, I'm not quite sure, this is the judge, I'm not quite sure why I'm doing this, but I had a dream last night, and this sage appeared to me. Very beautiful man with his hair piled up on his head, sage-like. Gray beard, hair. And he said, that man is innocent. You must release him. So, you're free to go. That was that. And he was released. Maharshi Nam Bhrigur Aham. I am Bhrigu. Krishna said. Yajnanam japa yagyosmi. Yajna of all sacrifices that you can do, japa yajna. I am japa. What is japa? Chanting of the holy names on tapamala, on beads. On beads. 108 beads on the mala. Chanting on beads has been used since time immemorial. Does it span more than one religion?
No.
Yes. Yeah, more than one. Mm-hmm. Do the Muslims chant on beads?
Yes.
Do the Catholics chant on beads?
Yes.
Do we chant on beads?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you chant japa?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Next beat. That's how you do it. Do it silent. You can do it softly. Sometimes they call it muttering. Muttering. That is the sacrifice. That's what Krishna says. That's the one. How many kinds of sacrifices or sacrificial performances or means of appeasing and invoking pleasing God are there? Numerous. Japa. Prabhupada has asked us to chant 16 rounds a day. A day. So if you can't chant 16, chant one anyway. Chant two. Chant what you can. Stavaranam Himalaya. What's the Himalaya? It's actually not Himalaya. It's Himalaya. Hima Alaya. Alaya means abode, and Hima means snow. The abode of snow. And stavarana means of things that are immovable, cannot be moved. I am the Himalaya. Well, that's pretty awesome. Have you been there? Have you been to Himalaya? You should go. It's fabulous. It's fabulous. Just to see it with your own eyes. The Nepali people are wonderful people. Wonderful people. Very sweet people. Then he says, Ashvata sarva vrikshanam. What's a vriksha? A tree.
I am the Ashvata. What is the Ashvata? The banyan, the fig tree. The banyan is the sacred tree. Tulsi is the sacred plant. The banyan is the sacred tree. What do we see in India around those huge banyan trees? They're just standing there. They put a whole apron around them usually. They put sort of like a cement apron around so you can sit on it. And then in the south, they paint the Ramanuja Tilak on them and around on the trees. So the banyan is a sacred tree. The fig tree. It's actually a fig tree. I don't think all of them produce figs, do they? All the varieties?
Some of them are fig-like.
Fig-like.
But they're not edible.
Not edible figs. Devarshi Nang Chanarada. Of the devas, the gods, and the rishis, the sages, I am Narada. Narada Muni. Narada Muni is a very interesting character in the Vedas. He shows up at the most interesting times to further the action. He's like a catalyst to, oh, by the way, did you know? Like this. What? I didn't know that. And the drama goes off in this direction, right? That's what he does. He's a bit of a stirrer. He stirs it up. But he's also a wonderful, wonderful personality. Highly devotional. And he is a master musician. Master musician. Why? Because in his previous life he was a Gandharva. So they sing, they dance, they play, they do all of it. Don't forget now, this is Krishna telling us who he is, who he manifests through, what he manifests through. This is Krishna hiding in plain sight. Right? Naranam cha naradipam. Among men I am the king. The king. Remember, they've said over the years, the divine right of kings. Have you heard that expression? And most of us nowadays are going, right, divine right of kings. Because you haven't seen any kings. Oh yeah, you've seen them. Or queens. That come up to the standard. Divine right of kings. So, I'm going to read this little bit from Prabhupada in the purport. Among the human beings, the king is the representative of Krishna. Because Krishna is the maintainer of the universe. And the kings who are appointed on account of their godly qualifications. Godly qualifications. Are the maintainers of their kingdoms. Oh, so he's saying in order to be a king or a queen and maintain a kingdom, you must have godly qualifications. Okay, make your list for me, please, of all the kings you know with godly qualifications. Kings like Maharaj Yudhishthir, Maharaj Parikshit, and Lord Ram were all highly righteous kings who always thought of the welfare of the citizens. Not the welfare of the bankers. Not the welfare of the corporate interests. Not the welfare of the developers or the real estate agents. No. The welfare of the people. In Vedic literature, the king is considered to be the representative of God. In this age, however, with the corruption of the principles of religion, monarchy decayed and is now finally abolished. Well, it's not exactly abolished in certain countries, but in many countries. It is to be understood that in the past, however, people were more happy under righteous kings. So the symptoms of Kali Yuga are corruption and hypocrisy, right? There was a king, King Anga. I don't remember what happened to King Anga, but after Anga, Vena was made king. This is historically in the Vedas. And Vena became a very, very cruel, heartless king, and was a pestilence on the people, on the society. So much so that the Brahmins had to put him to death. The Brahmins were so powerful back in those days that they could chant mantras and get rid of somebody. Can that actually be done? Yes. Well, that depends on their potency, on their purity, and how evolved they are. So perhaps so. Perhaps so. Some good.
So if they chant, the person just vanishes?
Well, no, he would die, you know. It's a way to get him to die without poisoning him, for example.
The soul then.
The soul of the king?
Of the person that vanishes.
He goes on to his next life, like anybody else would. So soul leaves the body.
That means it's interfering with God, or I don't know.
Well, in this case, because he was creating so much havoc, you know, let me explain one principle. The duty of the king or politicians, the leaders, is to, number one duty, Kshatriyas, to protect the people. That's it. In what way? In every way you can imagine. Especially from criminals, thieves, rogues, and people who prey on others. So if you got criminals, thieves, and rogues, do we have any in this country? Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, we got lots. They're in every country. So you, on the one hand, you got these preying on the people. Then you have a king, on the other hand, who's corrupt and cruel, and is also preying on the people. So now the people are in the middle of this. Huh? Do we see that in any examples in modern day, in any countries? Yes, of course we do. Especially with cruel dictators. We have that here. It's less obvious because it's done to the benefit of these corporate interests, banking interests, developer interests, international business interests, to the detriment of the people. As far as I can see, it's clear as the nose on my face. Huh? So that's what's happening. So they undertook to get rid of this king back in the day. And after that, Prithu was produced and made king. I won't get into that part of the story. But interestingly, Vena, King Vena, this cruel king, what is the English word we get from his name? V-E-N-A, Vena. Venal. Venal, bribable, corruptible. Isn't that what venal means? I told you, everything comes from Sanskrit. Ayudhanam aham vajram. Ayudha is a weapon. Krishna says here, I am the vajra. What's a vajra? The thunderbolt, the lightning bolt. That's what Krishna's weapon is. I am that weapon. Denu nam asmi kamaduk. Of cows. I am the Kamaduk. Or the Kamadhenu, Fourth Prabhupada explains, Surabhi cow. What does that mean? Those are cows. Do they have these cows? Yes. Are they here in Ireland or the UK? No. Nor in India right now. There might be, I don't know. They are cows that provide endless supply of milk. They're also cows that are called desire-fulfilling or wish-fulfilling cows. Whatever you want, you can get. We know that cow is the mother, a symbol for the mother. We've spoken about this many times. That's why the cow is sacred. She is a mother symbol. You do not eat the cow. You do not drink the blood of the cow. You drink the milk and make your butter and cheese and so many things, because it is the next most perfect food for an infant next to breast milk. Mm-hmm. But the symbology and the potency of the symbolism is extremely important with the cow. Now, the highest planet in the spiritual world is called what? Goloka. Loka means world or planet, and go means
cow.
The place of the cows. Who lives there? Krishna lives in Goloka. Why on earth would he live in Goloka? Does he not have a choice of places to live? He lives on the planet of the cows, where there are many, many cows. Okay. So let's not have that be lost on us. Prajanaschasmi Kandarpa. I am Cupid. Kandarpa is Cupid, or Madana is another name for Cupid. Because Cupid is sex desire, or the impulse for sex. The desire for sex. Why? For prajana. For reproduction. Reproduction of the species. It's very important to maintain reproduction of the species here in this world. Why? Because without a body, you cannot work through your karma and learn your lessons and grow and evolve and come to realize that you're not bodies, you're souls. So taking births until we are complete here and we become liberated and return to the spiritual world is vitally important. Vitally important. So a lot of people say, and nowadays, there's certain countries now where they're just not having children anymore. They go, oh, no, we're not having children. I think the Italians are not having children, and I can't remember what else. But having children is important for the souls to continue on their journey. That's the idea. Of course, we also know that sex life gets a lot of people into a lot of trouble. Correct? Oh, yes, my friends. It sure does. Open the newspaper. Especially now, huh? All this stuff's coming out right now about all these powerful men in powerful positions that have been taking advantage of women. Because they can't. It's all being flushed out into the open, isn't it? Interesting times. Okay. Well, he goes on. But I'll tell you what. We'll kind of conclude here. I wanted to say this. The 11th chapter, 1132. Robert Oppenheimer... Who is he? He is the father of the atom bomb. He was in charge of all the scientists that developed the atom bomb during the Second World War, which of course they subsequently dropped on Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, two cities. We all know that part, I think. When they set off the first test of the atom bomb, the atomic bomb, in, I think it was in the Nevada desert, this is what Oppenheimer said right after the test. And there were lots of people there, mostly military people and scientists, who were witnessing it, and I think the press. Quote, "We knew the world would never again be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent, witnessing the bomb. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he, the prince Arjuna, that he should do his duty, and to impress him takes on his multi-armed form," 11th chapter, Vishvarupa, "and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of the worlds." He quoted Bhagavad Gita when that bomb went off, or just after that. And then he said, "I suppose we all thought that one way or another. Now we have become death, the destroyer of the worlds." What is the word for death? What is the word that is used in the book here? Kala in this one. Kala. Mrityu is used, yes. Mrityu sarva harash chaham. I am death, which takes away everything. That's the verse that Kurma is referring to. In this verse, it's kalosmi. Kala means death, but it also means what?
Time.
Time, correct. How can death and time be the same word? How can that be? In this world, it's governed by the time factor, correct? Beginning, middle, end. For whom? Everything and everyone. Time factor. In the spiritual world, is there a time factor? Past, present, future? No. Is there death in the spiritual world? No. So Kala is time, and it is also death. Okay. I will conclude with that. We're going to chant Hare Krishna now, have an RT, an offering to the deity. And after that, we're going to have a lovely vegetarian prasad. No one died in the making of this food. So you can enjoy this prasadam guilt-free, especially knowing it was offered to God. Hare Krishna.